Thanks for listening to the Takeaway Podcast. Tell us what you think of it by leaving us a review on iTunes or by letting us know on Twitter or Facebook.
Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And we could play the Sopranos theme right now.
I come out here today to apologize to the people of New Jersey. I apologize to the people of Fort Lee. And I apologize to the members of the state legislature. I am embarrassed and humiliated.
It was a television classic, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie's national TV apology, followed by a tour stopping by Fort Lee, New Jersey, site of the scandal that began on September 9th when Christie aides closed access lanes to the George Washington Bridge. A scandal ensued, and his mea culpa also included a few "my staff let me downs." Heads rolled. Christie's not one of them, at least at this point. Here's a smattering of headlines for a guy who has mostly gotten wet kisses, if not a complete pass, from the press. Ignorance is Chris, that's the headline in the New York Post. One-word headline in the New York Daily News, pathetic. What's your reaction to the Chris Christie debacle?
This is John from Portland, Oregon. And as far as Governor Christie's contrite statement, we've heard this before. I think we've heard it in a movie. Gambling? I'm shocked. There's gambling here?
About the only thing that he didn't say in that little garbled message of Mayor Cooper was, I am not a crook.
From our Facebook page, Madeline says, I live in New Jersey and have been watching him long enough to realize there is something seriously wrong with this man. He cannot maintain the measured I am not a bully mantra for long. He's too unbalanced. Okay, is Madeline a Republican or a Democrat? Congressman Rush Holt has an address in New Jersey, but we know he is a Democrat representing the 12th District. Rush Holt's reaction?
It was vintage Christie. It really was, and I think if nothing more comes out of this, if this is the end of the story, a lot of people will think that he took care of it, that he handled it right.
Well, we will see. I want you to listen to this soundbite from the news conference yesterday, because I think this was actually one point where he was a little dishonest. Listen.
I'm heartbroken about it, and I'm incredibly disappointed. I don't think I've gotten to the angry stage yet, but I'm sure I'll get there. But I'm just stunned. And what does it make me ask about me? It makes me ask about me, what did I do wrong to have these folks think it was okay to lie to me? And there's a lot of soul searching that goes around with this.
Look, I believe he was stunned. I believe he's done soul searching, but I don't believe he hadn't gotten to the angry stage at that point. I think he was well past it. What do you think, Congressman Holt?
Well, he was variously sorry, angry, contrite, crestfallen, angry, disappointed, heartbroken, angry, embarrassed, exasperated, angry. And then he said, and I'm honored to be considered as a candidate for the presidency. I thought that was a little odd.
Well, he kind of had to go there. What do you think this says about his crisis management in terms of a run for the White House?
Well, I mean, if he didn't have direct participation in this really petty, vindictive action, he at least allowed it to happen in his office. That doesn't speak well for his management as an executive. And he seemed to be more sorry that he was betrayed than he was sorry about the effect on the people of New Jersey of petty, vindictive action.
That's an interesting insight, that's for sure. We'll leave it there. Congressman Rush Holt, Democrat representing New Jersey's 12th congressional district. Thanks so much.
Thanks. And we haven't heard the end of this.
A flatline on jobs. December jobs numbers show a paltry 74,000 jobs were added last month, a sobering data point for new Federal Reserve Chair Janet Yellen, someone who claims to consider jobs as important a measure of the U.S. economy as the Fed's traditional focus on inflation.
With unemployment still painfully high, job creation must be a high priority of monetary policy.
That's Janet Yellen speaking at her Senate confirmation hearing. Rana Faruhar, assistant managing editor of Time magazine and a contributor for WNYC's Money Talking, sat down with Yellen for her first in-depth interview since taking over at the Fed. Rana says modestly that Yellen's decision to do her first sit-down interview with Time magazine and not the financial press may be telling.
I think, and this actually speaks to the direction that the Fed may be headed, I think she was interested because Time reaches more of a middle American audience that goes beyond the typical reader of the FT or the Wall Street Journal. And the fact is that Janet Yellen has made it very clear that she's bringing a different style and a different focus to the Fed. She is interested in kitchen table economics. You know, she is interested in helping real people, working people. She grew up actually in Bay Ridge, Brooklyn, when it was a very working class neighborhood. Her father was a family doctor. She used to see laborers and factory workers coming in and paying $2 or not if times were hard to see him. So she has a real focus on employment and on the real economy as opposed to enriching Wall Street.
Ben Bernanke, of course, had a real focus on employment and spoke about it a lot and has written about it a lot. Where do you think, from her vision, Janet Yellen would take the mission of the Fed to improve the employment environment in policy terms? I mean, who does she want to hear the message that jobs are a real concern of hers?
Again, I think she's speaking directly to average Americans. Now, I think there's a lot of continuity between she and Ben Bernanke. I don't want to say there's not. She was his right-hand woman in terms of crafting the Fed's asset buying program over the last few years, and that's, as we know, really bolstered the value of the stock market. She's also someone who has been more willing than other people at the Fed to keep that program going on longer because she's very concerned that if the Fed scales back too quickly, the recovery, which is still pretty fragile, it could falter and that we could see unemployment tick back up. I think she's going to be really focusing on employment, even though the Fed has two jobs, keeping unemployment low, but also keeping inflation low. Inflation isn't really a worry yet because the recovery is not strong enough to create a lot of demand in the economy.
So she's a Fed lifer. Is she worried that, you know, she's been in a bubble and she really needs to project her sort of Bay Ridge creds maybe over her financial creds?
Well, that's interesting. The truth is she's a labor economist, so she has a lot of street cred already. She's not an expert in financial markets. And interestingly, I don't know if you remember back last fall, there was a moment, a few weeks, where it seemed that Larry Summers, the former Treasury Secretary, was actually going to get the job that she now has. And one of the sort of things that was put out there by his supporters in a bit of a whispering campaign in Washington and on Wall Street was that, hey, this is the guy who knows financial markets. This is the guy who's been through a crisis. Well, it's true that Janet Yellen is not an expert per se on financial markets as an academic. But remember, she was the first one amongst all the Fed officials to raise concerns about the subprime crisis. She was out at the San Francisco Fed in California at that time. And so she was really seeing that housing bubble brewing up from the ground up. And she said, hey, you know, these subprime loans that everybody thinks are not a big deal, this could really go mainstream. And boy, was she right.
And thinking then about the financial markets and how they've changed even since the financial meltdown of 2008 and 2009, does she have a sense of how the derivatives market, the global derivatives market, and that's something that the Fed really does have an impact on, is fragile, is, you know, holds the potential to really derail the economy, needs more regulation, is an opaque kind of black box to most Americans?
Yeah, I think that she's very pro-regulation. She's very pro-implementing Dodd-Frank properly. She actually said to me that although she thinks the Dodd-Frank financial reform laws are a good start and they provide a really good roadmap, that there may actually be more rules necessary. Banks may need to hold even more capital against their risks than they are now. The Fed doesn't regulate directly the derivatives market. That's done by the CFTC. But the Fed is the sort of uber banking regulator. And more importantly, the Fed chief sets the intellectual tone for is this a laissez-faire, markets know best sort of environment, as we saw with Alan Greenspan, or is this an environment in which we're going to see banks really need to watch the risk, be transparent, and follow the rules? And I'll just note an interesting thing, which was that in our photo shoot for the cover, we took a picture of her at lunch. She likes to eat lunch in the Fed cafeteria, not in the executive dining room. And she was sitting with a couple of people from the Financial Stability Board.
the cafeteria where she met her husband.
That's right. George Akerlof, Nobel Prize winner. Their son, Robert, is a professor. Some really smart dinner table conversations in that family.
So is this the job of a lifetime for her, or is she really presiding over the unhooking of the narcotic drip that quantitative easing has really inserted into the economy? It's going to be painful between now and the end of the year.
You know, it's really too soon to say. There's a lot that could go wrong. You know, if Europe blows up, if there's a Chinese debt crisis, she could have a really bad year. That said, so far, it's been smooth sailing. Most importantly, when you look at the minutes from the Fed meetings, the sort of insider talk, you see that there's a lot of consensus. So it seems like everybody's on the same page. And that's a big deal going forward because, you know, even if she has certain ideas, she's still got to get 18 other presidents and Fed governors to get on board with what she wants to do. So that kind of team building and CEO-type skill set is going to be really important for her.
Rana Faruhar is assistant managing editor of Time Magazine. Her interview with the new Fed chairman, Janet Yellen, is Yellen's first and a first outside of the financial press, which is a bit of a coup for you, Rana, I would say.
Thank you so much.
Rana Faruhar is assistant managing editor of Time Magazine and a contributor for WNYC's Money Talking. What if we could solve the problem of the nearly billion or so people without access to clean drinking water? A magic straw with an amazing cheap filter that you just pop into standing water and drink with confidence. We could save the unfortunates in the world with simple technology. Done! And then I hear from somewhere. The voice of reason.
The reality is nobody wants to drink water out of a dirty puddle. Put yourself in that position where you're kind of hunched over drinking water off of the ground.
That voice is Heather Fleming, engineer, CEO, looking at ways of developing technology that people will use beyond getting a standing ovation at some TED talk as the developers of the real-life Life Straw filtration device got a few years back. Fleming says useful technology in the developing world doesn't come from Western-style light bulbs going off.
People want to see that they're drinking something clear, and I think people don't want to just trust or rely on this invisible filter inside this straw, you know, that it's just going to take away everything that's impure in the water. There's just a few usability issues around it.
Later this hour, in part four of our Meeting the Standard series, Fleming and a colleague discuss the subtle challenges of making technology usable for everyone and opening the technological revolution to the developing world. On The Takeaway. His literary and political legacy might possibly be summed up in these words, a voice that could never be silenced. Death might be the only thing that could ever have silenced poet activist Amiri Baraka, once known as Leroy Jones. He died yesterday at the age of 79. Here he is talking about the death of Malcolm X, an event that changed him forever.
A guy named Leroy McLucas, a friend of mine, came in, a photographer, came in and said, Malcolm got shot. And that was actually not only for me the end of that book party, but I think for all intents and purposes it was the end of the whole, you know, phase of my life, because I thought in my mind that was a full open declaration of war.
There were many phases in the life of poet Amiri Baraka. Here's an example of some of his gentler words. Nobody sings anymore, and then last night I tiptoed up to my daughter's room and heard her talking to someone, and when I opened the door there was no one there, only she on her knees peeking into her own clasped hands. The opening of a book called Preface to a 20-volume suicide note. Amiri Baraka is perhaps most famous for his relentless activism in the fight for racial equality in America. Here he is speaking back in 2002.
But the Afro-American people suffer more than just racism. See, racism is what the liberal claims is our only problem, racism. But the Afro-American people suffer from national oppression, that is, from robbery, from the removal and elimination of our rights. You understand? So that when, for instance, we ask for reparations, you see, we not only want to sue you for, like, the national oppression, you know, robbery, fraud, lynching, kidnapping, child abuse, psychological attacks. But we want to sue you for all the caricatures you made of us.
I'm Mary Baraka speaking at a lecture at the University of Virginia back in September of 2002. Joining us now is Nikki Giovanni, poet and university distinguished professor at Virginia Tech. Thanks so much for being with us today. It's a sad day.
It's a sad day, and it's raining here. Huh. And I think that's so totally appropriate.
Remind us of the passionate honesty and even, you know, violent talk of a Mary Baraka and how it contributed to the political discourse of a time that we can barely remember today in our kind of cleaned up and whitewashed, if I may use the color white here, language in America.
I don't think we can barely remember it. I mean, many of us remember it incredibly well. One of the things that I think we have to remember about Leroy is that he was a lover. And I think that everybody wants to remember his poems, you know, Up Against the Wall, you know, and these are great poems, believe me. But he was a lover. And like all lovers, there's a great passion. And I think that, you know, to me, it's a bridge. And a bridge has fallen. And somehow or another, we're going to have to find a way from side one to side two. Because Leroy, and I've known him long, so anybody's complained about that, I'm not going to deal with it. But Leroy was the bridge between the generation, really, Langston, and my generation. So we all sort of knew him, but he also, he mentored us, but he also reminded us that you have to be clear. And as a poet, I think he's still, I think, underestimated and unsurpassed.
You know, that clarity is the thing I hold on to. I was reading Obits yesterday and you know, remembering some of his quotes and some of the things that he said, things that if people said that in public today, they would be in all kinds of trouble, as though we were a more violent society then than we are today. And I think almost the opposite is true.
I would agree. I think that, one, I don't think words are violent. I think that words are words are Windex. They clean the they let you see through. And people didn't sort of, a lot of people didn't like what Leroy had to say. But what he had to say was, we have to be truthful. And I think my generation definitely took that from him, that we have to be truthful. Well, being truthful isn't always being mean. It isn't always disliking people, though. Many people are well worth disliking, and we forget that. Everybody, you know, you want to be like, we love everybody, but everybody's not lovable. And I think that he brought that to us. You know, the last time I talked to him, though, and I just do want to share this. The last time I talked to him, he had called me because his son, Ross, you know, is running for mayor. And he called because he was raising funds. And I said, Leroy, why do you always call me when you want money? Why, you know, you never call me unless you're raising money for Ross. And he said, that's not true. And I said, well, when is the last time you called me to have a beer? And so he had to laugh. But I'm not as articulate as perhaps I can be in a week or two as we absorb this, because I only learned yesterday afternoon, a reporter actually called me and said, may I get a quote on the passing of Baraka? And I thought at first she was mispronouncing the president's name. And I said, oh my God, somebody shot the president. He said, no. And it was Leroy. And it was like, oh my goodness. It's taken me, it's just a part of my life that is just very difficult right now. It closes a window and it puts me in line. And I'm not sure how people like me are going to go forward. You know, what I'm just not sure where we go right now.
Can you remind us of his connection with the Beat Poets, the community in the village that you referred to, where there needs to be a memorial for him, in your view?
Oh, my. If you take Leroy out of the village, you put him in that Beat period of going to the village. You know, you had Steve and them all there together in a community. And ultimately, he's going to have to say, I think that Black people have special problems. The Beats are going to deal with Jack Kerouac, you know, and they were gays. And so you had all of that going on. But Leroy recognized, well, something else is going on. I need to be in Harlem. But if you subtracting him from the village would be like subtracting Jimmy Baldwin from France. Do you know what I mean?
I do. I do. I understand.
We can't let that happen. You can't just let him all of a sudden be, he's our radical poet. He was a great, he is a great poet. But a lot of it is how he grew from Newark to the Village to Harlem back to Newark. As I say again, I'm so apologetic that it's right now it's just being very emotional for me. And I was not prepared. I knew he was sick, but I was not mentally ready to lose him. And so there are things that I know I will be able to write about in a year that'll make way more sense than I'm making today. But you can't subtract parts of his life and say, that's why I started my thing to you with, he was a lover. And we cannot let that get lost in the fact that he was going to say, up against the wall, MF, this is a stick up. Because all of that is a part of who he is and what he's done. And we can't dissect the man and make him what we want him to be. He became who he was because he was willing to be who he is at every point in his life.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, you're doing fine. Nikki Giovanni, poet and university distinguished professor at Virginia Tech, talking about the many facets of Leroy Jones and Mary Baraka, who died yesterday at the age of 79. Nikki, thanks so much.
Oh, thank you.
There is a new reality in Iraq, and it takes us back to the troubled history of those two famous words. Remember them? Mission accomplished. Except this time, the mission accomplished in Iraq may be for Al-Qaeda, which, as we have reported on this program, has made significant territorial gains in central Iraq, Fallujah, and Anbar province, taking advantage of the civil war in Syria, and taking the country perhaps back to the worst days of 2006 and 2007. The fall of Fallujah and Ramadi, is it Iraq's version of the fall of Saigon back in 1975? Joining us is Anthony Cordesman, analyst with the Center for Strategic and International Studies, who recently co-authored a new report, Iraq in Crisis. Mr. Cordesman, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you.
What do you think? Any echo of the fall of Saigon in what's going on in Iraq right now?
Certainly not yet. I think the problem we all have is that this is not some kind of triumph by Al-Qaeda. This is not a rise of Al-Qaeda. It is a result of the fact there's been a Sunni-Shiite power struggle ever since the 2010 election that brought Maliki back to power. He's systematically become a Shiite leader. He's used the security forces systematically to repress the Sunni minority. He basically has been threatening tribal leaders that if they don't act and destroy the ISIS cadres, he'll send in the army and potentially do massive damage to the civilians.
We're talking with Anthony Cordesman, analyst with the Center for Strategic and International Studies. ISIS, the acronym you refer to there, is the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. That is the flag that Al-Qaeda is flying. Do you think there's any credibility to the notion of an Islamic State with territorial integrity from Beirut to Baghdad?
I don't think there's any credibility whatsoever. Again, ISIS is being decisively defeated inside Syria. It has not made gains in Lebanon. But these gains in the cities in Anbar only occurred through really drastic mistakes on Maliki's part.
But isn't Maliki taking a page from Bashar al-Assad in Syria, who, as you say, is defeating ISIS on the ground in Syria by being utterly brutal? Maliki's basically saying, well, let's do that in Iraq, and it's created, once again, another nightmare for the entire nation.
Well, understand, ISIS is being defeated by other Islamist movements, some of them funded and backed by the Gulf states. It's not being defeated by Assad's forces. The fighting that's going on is in western Syria, and it is between rebels, not with the Assad government. But certainly, the point you raise is broadly valid. If Maliki can't move towards a more national government, he does risk creating a civil war. It probably won't be taken over by ISIS, but it isn't something that is going to make it possible to have a stable democratic government.
Is there, in a final thought here, any suggestion that this is the end of the awakening, a complete rollback of the successes that the U.S. had working with tribal leaders in Iraq, or apparent success? And is there a U.S. play here? Do we have a stake in what's going on in Anbar right now?
Well, we certainly have a stake. We have a massive strategic interest in stability in Iraq because 20% of the world's oil exports come out of the Gulf. That affects the global economy and our economy as well.
Anthony Cordesman is an analyst with the Center for Strategic and International Studies. His recently co-authored new report is called Iraq in Crisis. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
We've spoken a lot about two societies in America, and I'm not thinking economically so much right now, as in the deep cultural division between Americans with a direct connection to the military and most of this country that does not. The America that knows firsthand about the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and the majority of Americans who do not. If they meet anywhere, it is in movie theaters, seeing films like The Hurt Locker, Black Hawk Down, Platoon, or the latest film about the war in Afghanistan, Lone Survivor. But for one detail, our next guest might have been in that majority group of Americans, unconnected to the military, except her son decided to become a Navy SEAL, go to Afghanistan, where he was killed in the battle that is depicted in Lone Survivor. That SEAL is played by actor Ben Foster, who you can hear among the voices in this scene.
Rules of engagement says we cannot touch them.
I understand.
And I don't care. I care about you. I care about you. I care about you. I care about you. We can't do
anything. Look at that soldier.
They are unarmed prisoners.
This is not a vote. This is what we're going to do. This op is compromised. We're going to cut them loose, and we're going to make this peak. When we make this peak, you're going to get comms up. We're going to call for extract, and we're going home.
Roger that, sir.
Roger that.
Roger.
Lone Survivor tells the story of four members of Navy SEAL Team 10 who took part in Mission Operation Red Wings back in 2005. Among the men who died that day was Matt Axelson, who Ben Foster plays in this film. And so Donna Axelson, Matt's very proud but still grieving mother, has seen this movie. Her life represents an intersection between the civilian and military world that is painful to be reminded of, and as we learned, is more real than any movie.
Within the SEAL community, it speaks to the brotherhood and it speaks to the team concept that is developed from when they first start buds all through their career with the SEALs. But the bigger picture is just the whole military in general and what they do for us to keep us safe and secure here at home. And I think the movie does an excellent job of doing that.
Before this movie was made, how many times in your own mind did you attempt to get a picture of what your son's last moment must have been like?
Well, after the rest of his teammates returned from deployment, the Navy and Naval Special Warfare were very concerned about the families. So his teammates visited the family of every SEAL who had been lost in Operation Red Wings. So we had met Marcus. So we knew from Marcus, even before he wrote the book, a little bit about the battle on the mountain. And one of the things that we said to Marcus from the very beginning is, we are grateful that he survived, because if he hadn't survived, then these men would have just been statistics on the evening news. But because he survived and because he had the courage to tell the story, we always tell him thank you. Because when people talk to him, they always ask him about the firefight on the mountain, which he will tell you is the worst day of his life. And he's had the emotional stamina and the courage to retell that to keep the memory of his teammates alive and to help people understand the courage of those men, both on the ground and in the helicopter that went down.
How much contact did you have with Ben Foster?
Oh, what a wonderful man he is. We met him in Albuquerque at the end of September. Peter Berg had the families back there to meet the men that were playing their sons and to meet a lot of the Hollywood people who were working behind the scenes. And we had the opportunity to be with Ben and to get to know him a bit and for him to get to know a little bit about Matthew from his family's point of view. So my son, my husband, myself, Matthew's widow were all there, and we had an opportunity to talk to Ben. And he did an absolutely outstanding job of portraying Matthew. Matthew was known for short little statements. And in the movie, many times, Ben just gives a short little statement that is so like Matthew. He did a wonderful job. And after we saw the movie, I texted Ben and I said, thank you for bringing my son back to me for a few hours. And he called me on Mother's Day and he texted me on Matthew's birthday. And then at Christmas again, he texted me. And he's just wonderful.
Is this a story of the power of movies, or is this a story of just, no matter what we think about the Stars and Stripes, this is such a waste to have lost this much? What do you think, Donna?
I don't think so, because remember, these are men who believe in what they're doing. When people tell me they're sorry for my loss, I understand that. And, you know, I would love to have Matthew back. But he was doing what he wanted to do. He wasn't drafted. You know, he had a college degree. He had a lot of things he could have done with his life. But this is what he chose. And as a mom, I supported him in that, and I had to respect that. A lot of people lose family members through disease or accidents. How wonderful to die doing what you believe in.
Well, you certainly testified profoundly as a mom for us. Before you go, as a movie reviewer, two thumbs up here, Donna?
Oh, at least two thumbs up.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your story and helping us to understand how much common ground there needs to be between your experience and the rest of America vis-a-vis these wars in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Thank you, John.
Donna Axelson's son was killed in the Navy SEAL operation fictionalized in the movie Lone Survivor. Listen carefully now to the sound of a tech legend. Doesn't sound much like Bill Gates. He's William Kamkwamba from Malawi, who, using discarded junk he found, brought electricity to his village, an inspiration that began with a picture of a windmill in a book.
A windmill could pump water and generate electricity. Pump water meant irrigation, a defense against hunger. This is what I need to solve this problem.
Kamkwamba solved his problem with enough ingenuity to catch the attention of MIT and the world. But no matter how easy it is to fall in love with stories like his, the tech challenges for helping the rural and undeveloped world are far more complex and defy the familiar star system. Joining us now in our fourth and final installment of Meeting the Standard are two engineers and evangelists for technological change who know a thing or two about engineering for people who might not ever have the chance to see an engineer in action. Noha El-Ghabashi is the Director of Engineering for Global Development at ASME Standards, and Heather Fleming, who we heard from earlier, CEO of Catapult Design. Her company designs tools for disadvantaged communities.
I think one thing that we tend to do with our Western perspective is assume that even though these challenges are similar all across the globe, that you can apply a single solution that will fix, you know, every community or every country or every region.
That's exactly right.
communities are not monolithic. And I think the expectation is often that it's about the technology, but when you consider people's cultural norms or their values, the technology could work perfectly. But if the people don't aspire to use it or don't feel like maintaining it in the way that it's meant to be maintained, then it's not going to get adopted and it's not going to be successful.
You know, I used to see this all over the world. I travel, I use a wheelchair, and I'd go to places where there were all sorts of people with disabilities and wheelchairs that had been donated that had fallen into disrepair almost immediately and were completely junked. And the people really just thought that was a nice idea, but they had no relevance to the people. But as soon as somebody built a wheelchair out of components that were available there in the neighborhood, in the community, then all of a sudden an industry was born.
That's exactly right.
What are the needs in these places and way beyond wheelchairs here, Noha?
Yeah, I mean, the needs are, there are so many of them. You know, we're talking about basic needs of transportation, health in general. We're talking about access to clean water. We're talking about access to electricity so that you can work or study beyond the dark hours. But they're incredibly complex, and there isn't an infrastructure to support a lot of the solutions long term to make them sustainable. You noted things breaking down. Well, if you don't build the capacity of the community to be able to repair the technology once it's broken, and it's inevitable that it will break at some point, then it's going to be stored in a storage room somewhere and it'll become junk, as you've noted. We see this happening at the community level, at the household level, at the clinic level, where there's a lot of machines that are fairly complex that are donated and then end up in a storage room. The danger in that is that it creates a dependency model, and it really doesn't move the needle on economic prosperity.
So how do you build entrepreneurship within a cultural context that will allow it to be sustainable? Because we don't want to leave the impression that, well, what we're talking about here are people who just aren't sophisticated enough to operate the advanced, you know, tools that we use here in the industrialized world.
Part of it is thinking of the entire ecosystem of the solution even before you begin to design anything. And so embracing the local marketplace, and often we're dealing with informal economies, using parts that are readily available, as you've noted, so that when something does break, you can find the parts to repair it. Training and capacity building in that regard is very important. So being able to understand the behavior of the community and how they go about in their everyday lives. And then beyond that, how do you create business models that allow for entrepreneurship to flourish?
What's an example of an engineering solution that may have been inspired from something on the outside, but really took hold in a way that was consistent with local sort of norms and approaches to technology?
One example that I can think of is the Embrace Incubator. That was an incubator that was developed by a group of Stanford University students. It costs much less than the traditional incubator, which is upwards of $20,000 to $40,000. And it's used to keep babies warm for 4 hours at a time using phase change materials. That one is a good example because the point of use is both at the clinic or at a home. You don't need to travel to a clinic to get to it. It's easy to maintain. It's easy to keep sterile. And it could be used on multiple babies in a particular village. But what's interesting about what they're trying to do is they're trying to look at alternative business models that allow them to not just donate incubators, but they have sort of a for-profit and a non-profit model that allows them to leverage the for-profit sort of commercial sense and then put some of the earnings of that into the nonprofit model. So innovation is not only happening on the technology level, it's also happening at the business model level and the economics level.
So you're director of engineering for global development at ASME,
yes,
right? And so you have to think in a completely different way to have any sort of success in your little part of the world here, right?
That's exactly right.
And so how hard is it for engineers to be forced to think low tech?
Well, it's hard, but engineers are trained to think about innovating in new environments. I think what's even harder is to really get engineers to think outside of the technical boundary conditions and to really think about people as human beings, not to use them as research projects, for instance. And that's what makes us thinking about standards in this space so complex, is that for them to be successful requires that we have an infrastructure to support standards.
I mean, if you have a standard for clean water, Heather Fleming, and you go into an environment where what's acceptable is water that just doesn't kill people. It doesn't have to, you know, meet the same standard of what's coming out of the tap, you know, in some hotel in the Bay Area. How hard is it for engineers to get behind something like that, where you're talking about acceptable clarity in the water so that it can reach the greatest number of people, and coming up with a technology that can deliver that?
The worst thing you could possibly do as an engineer is deliver a solution that will fail in a year or two, that people think they're drinking clean and safe water, but it's actually not delivering just that for whatever reason, whether it be that it breaks and people don't know how to fix it, or whether it be that you've designed it in such a way that people aren't using it correctly and therefore still drinking dirty or unclean water, but thinking that their children are not getting sick from the water because they're using this device that was supposedly engineered to some sort of standards.
To solve those usability issues and to redeem some of these technologies, Noha, do you think it's a collaboration with the William Kamkwambas of the world, the local sort of individual standout star geniuses, or are they really out of the picture? Is it going to be something that's going to have to be completely grassroots and independent of whatever MIT degree programs are offered?
There's a general movement towards the idea of co-creation. All right, you don't create a solution without engaging the end users, the communities themselves. I think where we perhaps sometimes fall into a trap of is not talking to the right people within the community, and those may not be the stars. Those may be the ones that are either using the products more frequently, or they're the ones that hold the institutional knowledge, the women of the community that don't typically get sort of the status of being the leaders or the stars. The other approach, of course, is, yeah, it would be great if we have more William Kamkwambas, if we have more innovators coming out of the communities themselves. Is the likelihood that the product may be more successful if we were to have them develop these? Maybe, maybe not.
Heather and Noha, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Heather Fleming is the CEO of Catapult Design, a product strategy firm that designs tools for disadvantaged communities. Noha El-Ghoubashi is Director of Engineering for Global Development at ASME. So earlier this hour, we were reminded that embattled New Jersey Governor Chris Christie said he was honored to be considered as a possible candidate for president in 2016. What do you think? Jay, New York, when you create a climate where your staff thinks it's okay to engage in petty bullying by modeling that behavior yourself, something's really wrong. React to anything on the program, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or go to our Facebook.com/The Takeaway page. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science. Neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.